Welcome to the Jamie Glazoff Show. Tonight, the Arab slave trade. Our special guest with us this evening, Stephen Brown, a columnist and contributing editor at Front Page Magazine. He has a graduate degree in Russian and Eastern European history, and one of his specialties and areas of research is the Arab and Islamic slave trade. Stephen Brown, welcome to the Jamie Glazoff Show.
Glad to be here again, Jamie. Very glad to be here. You forgot to mention there's also a book reviewer.
And you are an amazing book reviewer. And the giggle in the background is my tech wizard tonight, filling in for Daniel, Diane Zinn. Diane, thank you very much for being by my side tonight.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Diane. And Diane is a great fan of Steve. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to call in tonight to discuss the Arab slave trade and ask our expert, Stephen Brown, about it, our number is 347-857-1380. Steve, let's begin with you. We've been discussing this for years. Look, let's just even begin with this question. The left in the United States and America in general, it's in such control of our education system and the dialogue that slavery always appears to be connected to white people and to slavery in the United States when whites enslaved back many generations ago. And yet what many people don't know, because of the leftist control of the boundaries of our discourse, is slavery is alive today. Steve, tell us about it.
Oh, sure. Well, you see, it benefits the left to keep the focus on the transatlantic slave trade, to keep beating a dead dragon. Because the left hates America, it's a good weapon to keep hitting America with. Plus, it also allows them to portray Israel and the United States as the oppressors in the Middle East and the Arabs as the good guys still. So you're never going to get a true picture of what's going on over there in our schools or anything like that. But I must admit, there has been a lot of stories in the newspapers in the United States and elsewhere in the West about the Arab slave trade, but it doesn't seem to resonate. It seems to me, it's almost like Solzhenitsyn when he came to the West, he couldn't believe there's 30 or 40 memoirs on the Gulag in our libraries, and yet it never resonated, never took off until his book, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. We have memoirs by former slaves of the Arab slave trade, and yet nothing seems to resonate. Nothing seems to take off about it. It reminds me of a very similar situation, like with the Gulag.
Thank you, Steve. Well, Steve, look, tell us a little bit about it. Tell us about what's going on in terms of, till this day, Muslim Arabs are enslaving African blacks.
Oh, sure, Jamie. I wrote a story. I interviewed a former slave. He was... It's almost like something you thought had disappeared from history. He's captured in the slave raid in the 1980s in southern Sudan. They killed his father, and his mother and his sister disappeared. He was 7 years old. He's taken to northern Sudan and was employed as a goat herder for the next 10 years till he's 17, until he escaped. It was just horrendous, horrific, you can imagine. I interviewed him and wrote a column for Front Page Magazine. His name is Francis Bach, and he wrote a book, Escape from Slavery. And ultimately, he did escape and made his way to Cairo, and he came to the United States as a UN refugee. All you have to do is read that book to find out what's going on. Now, that's one part. Sudan is a very important part of the Arab slave trade. A lot of slaves that wind up in the underground slave network in Saudi Arabia and the Arabian Peninsula do come from Sudan. The other west of that, in countries like Niger, Mali, and Mauritania, where there's hundreds of thousands of slaves, I think it's hard to get an exact number because some of these slaves belong to the nomads still, so they don't really know how many they have, but in Mauritania, the anti-slave organization estimates about 500,000 in Mali, about 200,000 in the northern part of Mali. Niger, they estimate there's probably about 50,000 slaves there, and they're all black Africans who are the slaves of Arab and Berber masters. But this is hereditary slavery. They've been slaves for 300-400 years, and they simply don't know anything else except being slaves.
Now, and Steve, and who are the slave masters?
Well, like I said, they're Arabs and Berbers. They are the ruling classes in these countries. Mm-hmm. And at least in the northern part, let's say Mali, in the southern part, it's the black Africans who rule the country. The northern part that's in revolt, or was in revolt, are the Tuaregs, are Berbers. In Mauritania, it's Arabs and Berbers who rule the country. And in Niger also, it's seems to be an Arab population there that's enslaving the black African population, or has black African slaves.
Now, Steve, why is it that, you know, if, you know, why have we never heard Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton say a word about this? Aren't they concerned about slavery?
Well, believe it or not, Al Sharpton did go to Sudan. One of the, plus the only good thing he's ever done, he went to Sudan and did condemn the slave trade
mm-hmm.
there. And he did call a spade a spade. But the thing
wow.
is this, the
but
thing
you don't
is
hear
this,
him
is,
talking about it, yeah.
It just doesn't seem to resonate. You know, like, Solzhenitsyn had the question, why wasn't the Gulag, why did it have to wait till 1974 until his book, Gulag Archipelago, came out, that the Gulag became embedded in the Western conscience? It's like we're almost waiting for a Gulag Archipelago on the Arab slave trade to come out, even though there's been memoirs, former slaves, they've been on TV, they've been interviewed. you know, you've published a, my column, Francis Bock, the former Sudanese slave boy, but somehow it just, even there was one black African PhD candidate named Samuel Cotton from New York. He went to Mauritania, interviewed slaves, photographed them, documented it, came back to the United States. He thought there would be a great swelling among the African-American community there against this black slavery in Africa. And yet when he went around talking to all these black groups, he said very few showed any interest.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we definitely know, Steve, that for the left, it pretends it's concerned about all these issues, whether it's slavery, gay rights, women's rights. But if it's not part of their agenda, which is to wage war on Western civilization, to destroy capitalism, to destroy democracy, if it's not part of that agenda, they're simply not interested. So they are ready to sacrifice black Africans on the altar of their ideals. They're heartless, and they don't care, because Arabs running a slave trade, being inspired by Islam, they don't want to accept that, because then they would have to criticize Islam and criticize the Arab world, and God forbid if they did that, it might end up justifying Western civilization.
You know, it's even highly hypocritical, even more hypocritical than the Israelis, how they criticize Israeli over the Palestinian situation. It's how the left came out and screamed in moral outrage about apartheid in South Africa. Now, don't get me wrong. Apartheid was a cruel system that had to be ended. But it's strange how they were so morally outraged about apartheid in South Africa, yet couldn't care less about the Islamic slave, the Arab slave trade going on at the same time in Northern Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Again, they only seem to be interested where they can get point out anti-white racism or the transatlantic slave trade to America. They don't seem to care unless it fits that, like you said, that agenda theirs.
Well, Steve, now, give us a little bit more detail about the barbaric, elements of this trade, how vicious and sadistic, how barbaric it is, what inspires it. Tell us the role of Islam in this. This is very interesting, and it's hardly ever discussed in our mainstream media.
Well, Bernard Lewis said that Sharia law and all four schools of jurisprudence of Islamic law, slavery is legal. And it's not just legal, it's elaborately regulated. So there's nothing moral, really, about taking a person as a slave, because it's legal under God's law.
Mm-hmm.
They see nothing. It doesn't bother their conscience whatsoever. And those Arabs who do, those Muslims who do speak out against it are vilified and sometimes arrested. Like, for example, a professor in northern Sudan spoke out against the slave trade, and he was arrested and thrown in prison. An Egyptian Islamic theologian spoke out against saying that it's against the Quran to make non-Muslims pay the special tax, and also it's against the Quran to take slave girls. Well, he was declared an apostate, and they took him to a Sharia court, even though he didn't appear at the court or anything, and forcibly divorced him from his wife, even though his wife didn't want to divorce him, because now he's an apostate, a Muslim woman can't be married to a non-Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to flee Egypt, because now he's an apostate, the Islamic extremists were after him to kill him.
Hmm.
This is all for being against slavery. So you see the difficulty here. But there's more to it than that. There was an Australian writer, John Laffin. He wrote a book called Arabs as the Master Slavers. He sees religion as justifying for the Arabs the slave trade, but I think he came closer to the truth when he said the Arabs seem to have this need. Is it that quote? Is there does exist in Arabs a need to dominate as a servient class?
Mm-hmm.
You see, what has to be pointed out is that a lot of these, all these slaves, these hundreds of thousands of slaves in Niger, Northern Mali, and Mauritania, they're all Muslim. And according to Sharia law, you're not allowed to enslave a Muslim. So right there, they're not even obeying their own Sharia law.
But
so
you of course you can enslave a non-Muslim.
Of course you can enslave a
non-Muslim. Yep. Yep.
But these Muslims, these slaves in Niger, Mali, and Mauritania have been Muslims for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the slave raids in Sudan, they raid black African Muslim villages. Mendi Nazir, she wrote an autobiography. She was, a 12-year-old girl. She was captured in a slave raid and brought to the north. And she informed her new mistress, master, that had bought her. She said, "I'm a Muslim." And they told her, "Islam's not for black people."
Hmm. Wow.
And here's an interesting story. There's such little fear of Western laws that her mistress sent her to her sister in London. Her brother-in-law in London worked at the Sudanese embassy as a press attaché. So he'd be the one denying to the world that there's any slavery in Sudan, and yet he's a slave right there in his house in London. And
absolutely.
She escaped.
Oh, okay.
It's incredible.
Yeah, tell us how that ended up. She ended up escaping?
She ended up escaping. Not only that, she wasn't his first slave there. The previous slave had also escaped, too.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even in America, there doesn't seem, you know, there was a woman in New York State from Indonesia, her and her husband. They had a couple of Indonesian maids and, you know, just brutally treated them. They're just slaves. And she got 11 years in prison. There was another Saudi guy in Colorado, him and his wife, they had an Indonesian girl using her as a sex slave. He got 17 years in prison. He couldn't understand it. He says, according to my laws that I live by, I've done nothing illegal, and the United States should change its laws to reflect where I come from. You know, that's what he basically said.
And I want to just keep hitting away at this. It's incredible that leftist feminists, that academics, that the left in general are just silent. They don't say a word about this modern-day slavery on the soil of the United States of America when these people come with their different ideologies and cultures that are barbaric and backward. And once again, the left won't say a word because its agenda is to wage war on its host society, and so therefore doesn't really care about people. And let me bring up some people it doesn't care about as well. How about the children, Steve? You're an expert on this.
Mm-hmm.
Till this day, used as camel jockeys in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah,
I mean,
there's still a big underground camel racing industry using the camel jockeys there.
Mm-hmm.
And when that was abolished, the Pakistani welfare organization that was looking after these boys estimated there's 6,000 of these boys in Saudi Arabia. 5,000 were sent back. And so that means 1,000 were kept there and probably went into the underground racing the camel racing. And those boys that did come back didn't have a very good fate either, a lot of them. Some were resold back to the Persian Gulf as camel jockeys. And and others were the extremists. Madrasas got a hold of them in Pakistan. So what god awful horrible lies these kids. Mm-hmm. Just, but you see, that's one thing always when I've studied this is how they focus a lot on children, and they always seem to be going to Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf. Mm-hmm. Like when Samuel Cotton investigated slavery in Mauritania, which is on the Atlantic coast, he discovered a big connection between children disappearing and going to and being sent to the Arabian Peninsula. Mm-hmm. Also, children are bought from Egyptian orphanages. Also, we know from Pakistan and often in third world countries, they find children leaving from airports headed for the Persian Gulf with false documents. They really focus a lot on buying children. And, you know, it's really just incredible. Like Osama bin Laden, for example, he's given 1 million acres of land in Sudan, and apparently he had black African slave children working his farm there, which apparently grew marijuana. This all came out at a committee in the parliament in Uganda. And all those children he got from the Lord's Resistance Army, who sold about 30,000 children in Sudan that they had kidnapped. The Lord's Resistance Army was being supported by the Sudanese government in Khartoum. And apparently he paid 1 Kalashnikov for each child that he received. So, I mean, this all came out in this committee. I don't know how much of that is true or not, but believe me, I wouldn't doubt it. Stephen Lewis.
Thank you very much, Steve. 1 second. Let me bring Diane, my co-host, into this for a minute. Diane is a regular researcher. She sends me a lot of links and keeps me updated on everything for my work at Front Page, which I very much appreciate, Diane. Diane, you read a very interesting article on the sex slave trade in Afghanistan today.
Yeah. The headline was Afghan Farmer Beheaded with a Penknife After Refusing to Let Drug Lords Take His Daughter and Sell Her as a Sex Slave. How's that for a heading?
Yeah, I read that too. It's
and these men are becoming indebted to they fall into debt with gangs, and then they're supposed to be giving their little girls as young as 10 years old to these drug gangs as sex slaves. And this woman is, the wife is saying, if she doesn't give up her daughter, then they're going to kill her husband. So it always seems to be about sex.
Well, that's just it. You know, that's what a lot of it is. They send the boys to the Arabian Gulf to race camel jockeys, and the little girls sent there to grow up as sex slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it seems to always be about. There is, Stephen Lewis, for example, he's a former Canadian ambassador to the UN, and when he's with UNICEF, he went to Omar Bashir, president of Sudan. He was put in power by the Muslim Brotherhood, and he tried to get some of these children that were sold by the Lord's Resistance Army in Sudan, tried to free them, bring them back to Uganda. And Bashir just denied outright that any children were there. And yet he had 60 children in his own custody that he smuggled out of the country. But he said he just couldn't believe when he talked to Bashir. He had a personal audience with the president of Sudan about slavery, the slave children. And he said, I feel like I encountered evil incarnate. The fact that he was knowingly presiding over the death and emotional dismemberment of thousands of children mattered to him not one whit. So this is what you're dealing with. So it's going to be very, very hard to abolish slavery in the Arab world, in the Islamic world. It's simply a mindset that's very established for centuries, and they also have the feeling that due to their racial superiority that they have also the right to enslave other people, especially non-Muslims.
And this is the key distinction we have to make. Which the left just, you know, it starts gnashing teeth and foaming at the mouth when you say this, but it is the truth. When it came to slavery in the West, when it came to American slavery, look, that existed because of its time and place, but it had to go because the foundation of our society is Judeo-Christian. It is the Judeo-Christian tradition that recognizes the sanctity and the sacredness of every individual, that recognizes the equality of human beings in front of the Lord and in front of God. Now we have the American Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, those beautiful documents, as well as the New Testament. All of this served as a crippling force against slavery. Slavery cannot coexist with this. But in the Islamic world, you can't have people get up and start preaching against slavery, because Islam serves as the buffer to slavery, whereas the Judeo-Christian tradition serves as the crippler of it.
And that's why the churches were the main force behind the abolition movement in the Western world.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Islamic world, there's never been an abolition movement. There's never been a civil war fought over the abolishment of slavery. There's never been a movement to establish the humanity of the black African slave like there was in the West. Like you said, Jamie, it's due to the mosque or the religion.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's the big difference. In the West, the churches worked hard to abolish slavery, while in the Islamic world, Sharia law has kept it alive right till today. And not only that, it's sanctioned the slave trade. Whereas when the slave trade was going on in the West, there's always heavy criticism of it, people writing against it, especially those in the churches. But in the Islamic world, there's no such thing. It's just a part of daily life. It's accepted. It was all elaborately regulated, like Bernard Lewis said, by Sharia law.
Absolutely. And so, therefore, in the West, what the beauty of Western civilization is, the dark forces have to leave. They cannot exist. It's like butter being evil, melting on heat. And the heat is the American Constitution, American Declaration of Independence, the New Testament, the Judeo-Christian tradition, right? But in the Islamic world, it's not going to melt, because there is no heat, in the sense that the buffer is Islam, and slavery is deeply rooted in Islam, and especially the enslavement of the infidel.
And I'd also like to see equally also in not just Islamic supremacism, but also Arab supremacism. It's also very, very racial in the Arab world, the slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as abolition goes, I think we should bring that up now. Like, I don't see much hope for it being abolished.
Mm-hmm.
You can't look to the UN Human Rights Council for abolishment, because it has some of the slave practicing countries are seated on the council.
Mm-hmm.
And the Organization of Islamic Conference protects countries like Niger, Mali, Mauritania. Now, the big question is, why don't black African countries scream their lungs out about the slave trade going on? They know what's going on.
Yeah. Well, Steve, how about this? Imagine if whites started enslaving blacks again in the U.S. South, and imagine the left rising up when we started criticizing it, saying, no, that's Amerophobic. That's Americanophobic, or whatever word they would describe. You can't criticize the enslavement of blacks in America because, you know, that's Americophobic. Now, that just sounds absolutely ridiculous, right?
Yeah, of course.
We would have to denounce it. However, today, that's what they're doing. If we criticize the enslavement of blacks in Africa by Muslim Arabs, that's exactly what the left does. It's Islamophobic, and you cannot criticize anything that Islam does. And that's why they're simply betraying tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of oppressed black people in Africa under the Arabs.
You know, I was just going to say, I missed a little bit of what you said because I was on a call, but I just see this, the whole sex slave trade part of this, I think is so predominant because the Muslim men are compelled to rape and abuse all the non-Muslim women, correct?
Right,
I mean, if they're seen as in a battle with the West or any enemy, That's what they're commanded to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why all the Scandinavian countries are just, Europe's just going nuts with the rapes and the UK, all over. Isn't that right,
in,
Steve?
Yeah, in Sweden, it's just an absolute epidemic now. And you can't say anything, but 80%, 77% of the rape cases are by immigrants from Muslim countries. And this is something that the media will not talk about. But in every single one of those rape cases, the rapist will tell you, what did I do wrong? The Quran and my Islamic theology tells me I can rape a kafir.
Right.
And we cannot say anything about this, Steve?
No, it's true. You can't say a word. Also, I just want to point out, one of the reasons they think for jihad was that they needed always a new supply of slaves, too. So that's why they had to keep attacking non-Muslims, to keep that pipeline of slaves going.
Well, also, there are many Filipinos, I believe, in Kuwait, is it?
Kuwait, Saudi Arabia. They come from Pakistan, Bangladesh.
And they come to work there legitimately, but then they aren't paid, they're abused, they're raped, they're beaten.
Oh, sure, yeah,
yeah.
They think they're buying a slave. They think they're buying a slave.
Uh-huh, and they're not. The Filipinos don't think. They think they're coming to work.
Yeah,
just a tragedy. Just an absolute tragedy. One second, Steve. I got to interrupt for a minute. Our phone lines are jamming in. Ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Brown, columnist and contributing editor at frontpagemag.com. He is an expert in the field of the Arab slave trade, and also, of course, on honor killings that he's written a lot about, especially in Europe. Call in and talk to him at 347-857-1380. 347-857-1380. We are going to go to Kath, calling in from Ohio.
Good evening, Jamie.
Thank you for calling in, Kath.
Yeah, I have a question. I can't remember the guest's name. I'm sorry. But I have a question for him. I recently watched a documentary about a woman from England, and she went to an African nation. I'm uncertain what nation it was. And she bought slaves. And they were saying how some people think that it's not a good thing to do because it encourages the people to round up the slaves for them to buy them back. Have you heard about that?
Yeah, there has been. There are organizations who go to Sudan and have bought slaves back, redeemed them from their owners in northern Sudan. They pay these Arab middlemen to go around and buy these slaves off, and they bring them back to sell them to Sudan again, and where they are released.
Exactly.
Of course, that's the argument. It only is serves to instigate more slave raiding if these people know, you know, if the slave owners know they're going to be paid to release the slaves.
Exactly. Yeah, but I was amazed.
What's that?
Go on.
Oh yeah, they freed hundreds of slaves like this. Like I said, the critics say it only instigates more slave raids. But then again, when you look at from the point of view of the slaves who are free, you're awfully glad that these people did redeem them.
I was thinking that when I saw the, because there was a whole group of children, and they were saying how sometimes they paid $50 a person, sometimes they paid $100 a person. But she had like, I want to say 250 that she had bought that just for that trip alone. And
right.
I thought the people that had received their freedom, they have to be absolutely thankful for that.
Oh.
But I also see the other side because she couldn't get the government, and there was an agency. I don't know if it was Red Cross or it was a relief agency that would not help her at all. And the government said that they were going to shoot her plane out of the sky if she went to go do this. It was a fascinating documentary.
Unfortunately, I don't see. I really don't see. You know, such a terrible thing. I just don't see much chance for abolition in the near future. You know, because slavery, for example, was only abolished in Saudi Arabia in 1962, and. You know, something that was like that for centuries and centuries and centuries is just not going to disappear overnight. And it's
going
to be very, very difficult to stop this.
the Philippine people that they go to Saudi Arabia thinking that they're going to get a large amount of money and bring it back to their families, and they're basically slaves. So
They now stopped that. The Philippine government has stopped its these women from going and working in Saudi Arabia because of the terrible, terrible treatment there. Some are killed there. A lot of them are raped. They're treated like slaves. Exactly. The Saudis, some of these Saudis think that they're buying slaves.
Yeah. Well, I thank you very much for taking my call tonight, and thank you for giving me your insight. I will talk to you later. Thank you, Jamie.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much for calling in, Kath. Thank you. Steve, and another problem, look, I want to get back to slavery, of course, but I want to take advantage of this time of it's such a privilege and an honor to have you on the show because you are full of so much knowledge on slavery, but also honor killings that are just spreading epidemic in the West.
Well, they're becoming mainstream in Europe.
Tell us about what's happening in Europe in terms of honor killings, and it seems that Europe is just desensitized to this mass crime against women, especially Islamic women.
Well, it's just like in Islamic countries now. You know, they're just desensitized to this, and there's a coming to that in Europe. The media is also being blamed for printing stories about this by the left, saying, "Oh, you're being Islamophobic," like you're mentioning before. This doesn't help with integration when you do this type of thing. When you report on honor killings and these other things. But, you know, it's becoming mainstream, and that's the sad part about it now. People are just accepting, or just seem to be just accepting it. It's here now, and it's here to stay, and it's going to keep on increasing.
Yeah.
Just, like you said, just desensitized. It reminds me sort of like the shootings in the inner cities in America,
mm-hmm.
where people are just kind of desensitized to that type of thing now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
Are people becoming desensitized to what's happening in the Muslim community in Europe? You know, this honor killings and these other kinds of things, forced marriages and this type of thing. People are just becoming desensitized to it.
Yeah. We're going to go to a call. 1 second, Steve. And hello, we are on the Jamie Glasow Show. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Jamie. Hi, Steve. Thank you for being on the show.
What a great honor for Nani Darwish to be calling the Jamie Glasow Show. Thank you, Nani.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm really excited to hear Nani.
You're an expert on this. What can you tell us?
Well, I'm glad at least it's being discussed and Steve is speaking about it because here we are, we live in America, and we keep accusing everybody of being a racist and a bigot and Islamophobic, but we are ignoring this tragedy that's all over the Middle East and Africa, and it's done by Muslims, the same people I came from.
Two other Muslims too.
Absolutely, and this is so entrenched, Steve, in my culture of origin. It is. It's humiliating and just enslaving people is part of the culture. And recently, a few years ago, I think, there was a Saudi prince who was in London with his gay eunuch slave.
Yes.
In the open, openly. And he actually killed him.
He was beating him
in the elevator.
Yeah.
In front of everybody, dragging him, treating him like a slave.
Right.
There are videos on the internet where people are using whips in Saudi Arabia on people like the trash collectors or maids. The stories that I hear about enslavement people who work for you. I know people who work in Saudi Arabia in office work, and they are treated by their superior very poorly, almost like slaves.
Well, you know something, Noni, it's not, you know, in Brussels, for example, the widow of the Emir of Oman was living in a hotel, the whole floor of a luxury hotel with 17 slaves.
Yes.
It's incredible. But also, you know, what they don't understand in Europe is that white slavery is increasing too. In the Caucasus, they've been enslaving Russians. There's been stories coming out of enslaving Russians, and more there's been a pipeline from, like, Geneva of young women to Saudi Arabia that have been kidnapped.
Absolutely. There are sexual slaves from everywhere you can think about in the Muslim world. And as a matter of fact, a few hundred years ago, there used to be a class in Muhammad Ali's time of people who were called the owned Mamluks, the word Mamluk.
Yeah, yes, yes.
The
Mamluks.
And this
soldier
slaves. Exactly. These were bred. They were kidnapped from their families in Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
And they were brought to Egypt, and they were treated like slaves. And then they took over the power in Egypt for about 100 years, believe it or not, because they became very powerful.
I think maybe the only reason Saudi Arabia might have abolished slavery because it made it vulnerable to criticism in the international community, like at the United Nations. And also, how could Saudi Arabia claim to lead the Islamic world when it's to these black African Muslim countries when it's busy enslaving its citizens? So
the truth is suppressed when it comes to Islam. Islam does act in one way and advertise itself in a different way. They enslave people, but they say we are a religion of peace. We freed slaves, and they say that. And Islam ended slavery not because it was a movement from within, like you said, and I'm very glad that you exposed that. It was actually in response to Western liberation from slavery. And it was a response to America, to be more exact.
Well, they're also being criticized by the black African Muslim countries, too.
Exactly.
Because, hey, our citizens are going to Mecca on the Hajj, and they're being enslaved when they get there.
Oh, even Egyptians who, when they go to Saudi Arabia to perform the Hajj or to work, they're very mistreated. Foreigners in general are mistreated in Saudi Arabia. They are very... Perhaps Saudi Arabia is the most ethnocentric country on earth.
Sure.
They are the most proud. They look down on every other culture and race. And call America racist. It's just unbelievable.
But how do they justify that going on the... People don't realize Mecca used to have a big slave market. Like, how do they justify going on the Hajj and selling and buying slaves there? And yet it's supposed to be a religious trip to purify the soul. Like, how does that get justified in a person's mind?
That's the hypocrisy of Islam, and that's why, Steve, I left the religion.
Yes.
Because I lived in this hypocrisy and this tyranny and oppression. When you have a culture that allows slavery like that to flourish, believe me, it spreads to other areas of life. It spreads to the treatment of the children, the treatment of women, the treatment of a boss to an employee.
Just a general moral corruption.
The whole culture becomes an enslavement culture. And that's why we have dictators. Because
one of the things I was reading about the Mecca slave trade, how rich Muslims would go with their slaves to Mecca, and along the way they'd sell them, like, to have money for the trip. They sell their slaves like we would use traveler's checks on the way going to Mecca.
Yep.
This is something we just can't even imagine. There's a guy from your country. He had a real racket going in Egypt. He'd marry a woman, take her on the Hajj, and then when he's there, he'd say she wasn't his wife and sell her. Apparently he sold 65 women before he's finally caught.
Oh, I'm not surprised at all. It is, this is the contradiction that nobody wants to talk about. No, nobody wants to talk about, including Muslims themselves. and I'm on the phone a lot with my cousins in Egypt, and they're in denial. And everybody's in denial. It's, even the West is in denial. So it's not going to solve. We're not going to solve the problem, and we're not helping Islam if we keep finding excuses for Islam. And that's why I salute you for speaking out about it and being so knowledgeable about it. Thank
you. Well, thanks very much, Noni.
Let
me just ask you a question. It's a thing that I see all these Muslims, hundreds of thousands of slaves in West Africa,
mm-hmm.
and yet they turn around and they tell them, oh, it's legal according to Sharia. But it's not, isn't it? They're not allowed to enslave Muslims, are they?
Yeah. According to the to Islam, you can enslave non-Muslims, but you know, the slave markets included Muslims. I guess.
What does Sharia say about enslaving Muslims? Is it legal or not legal?
You know, this is a good question. There were most of the Muslims that existed in Egypt during my grandmother's time. I never saw it, but she says that most of them became Muslims.
Nani.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. I'm sorry, I did interrupt. I thought you were
finished. Sure, go ahead.
Oh, this is Diane.
Hi, Diane, how are you?
Hi, good. I did you all bring up the information about when the U.S. became a nation after the Revolutionary War, how the Muslim pirates were going around and capturing people in Jefferson.
Oh, yeah.
Jefferson sent our...
200 years ago. I mean, when
started. And then he sent over our military and our navy to free them. And
yeah,
they were
absolutely
captured and enslaved in Northern Africa by the Muslims.
And they did ask the Libyan ambassador, why are Muslims going on ships and enslaving Europeans? They,
mm-hmm.
they used to go all the way to Ireland.
They went to Iceland.
Ireland.
In England, yeah.
To England, all the way to the villages on the ocean and go in the villages and practically take everybody in the village. And
no.
Some villages had nobody, were found with no inhabitants in it. And they used to take them and just sell the young women for sexual slaves, and the children, they will breed them to become slaves, and the men for hard work, labor. I mean, it was, this is how the truth, and nobody wants to talk about it.
Yeah,
you know something? It was even
right.
worse in Eastern Europe, because there they would go on slave raids and capture like 20,000 at a time, right up into Poland from the Crimean Peninsula.
And the sad part is that, you know, there's a Saudi preacher recently that came out and said a fatwa that to allow jihadi fighters inside Syria now, today, to rape the Syrian women.
Oh, my
and
God.
That, yes, he said that it's okay because these fighters are doing Allah's work, so the women should allow them to rape them. And they would call it a temporary marriage, like it's a half-hour marriage or an hour marriage. And the women should not complain, because this is something that will that is for the sake of the jihadis, which is the highest honor, so to be raped by a jihadi.
Yeah, and once again, ladies and gentlemen, once again, we don't see any protests from any women's studies departments across the United States campuses. We're going to go to a call. Noni, please stay with us for a minute if you can. We're going to go to Lucha from San Diego. We are going to go to Lucha from San Diego.
Hi, Jamie. Hi, Stephen. And hi,
hi
Noni.
Lucha.
And hi, Diane. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about the slave thing, and it's kind of like a two-part question. So, Stephen, which country, and I'd like to ask just the first question before I ask the second part of the question, which nation, which country is most notorious for the slave trade?
or I think Sudan at the moment, because of the violence of the of their collecting slaves. I don't think it has the most slaves, but we all know the violence that's from the memoirs that have come out and from the reporting from international, like actually slave raids, destroying villages, killing the people that they can't sell or don't want, and taking mostly women and children, killing the men. And like I said, it's like going back to the 1800s, the old slave raids. That's exactly what it is. Just the weapons are more powerful now. So I think Sudan is probably the most notorious now for slavery.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. And do you think the United States is enabling it by not speaking out about it? Because we don't hear anything about this in the mainstream media.
Funny you should mention that, you know. When Obama made that trip to Africa and visited that slave fort, he never mentioned Islamic slavery at all. And it's only going on a couple of countries above, I think it was Ghana, that slave fort that he visited. Did mention a word about Islamic slavery and the 500,000 slaves in Mauritania or those other ones. And because he's doing what the left does. He's keeping that focus on the transatlantic slave trade. He's also playing to the black audience in the United States, the African-American audience. Like I've already said on the show, it doesn't resonate with them, Islamic slavery, enslaving black Africans. Mm. So I think you really hit on something there when you said the United States enables it when the President of the United States goes over there and doesn't even mention it. And in fact, mentions a slavery that's been dead for 160 years.
Nani,
exactly.
Before we let, one second, Nani, but we're so grateful that you phoned in tonight. Before we let you go, do you have a quick final comment for us?
Well, it is about nobody, not Obama, nobody in the Democratic Party, the Black Caucus, Jesse Jackson, you name it, nobody cares. And that just tells me one thing, that really these people don't really care about black issues or slavery issues. I don't really believe them anymore. I think probably Steve and me and Jamie, we care more about the issue of slavery than the black caucus in the Congress. That's my last comment, and thank you.
Yeah.
Steve, and thank you, Jamie, for taking my call.
Yeah,
thank you,
Nani,
so much,
thank
Nani.
You. It's been an honor talking to you. Believe me,
yeah.
I've read your books, and keep up the good work, okay?
Thank you. Thank you so much. Bye.
Nani, I'll see you at an event in Los Angeles probably very soon. Thank you very
okay,
much.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye-bye. And Lucha, any final words of wisdom from you?
Nani is an amazing woman, and I would love to have her and Jamie. I'm going to be emailing you this week about being on our show. So,
okay.
Thank you for what you do. Thank you, Stephen, for...
You're welcome, Lucha. Thank you for calling in tonight.
Yes, thank you, guys.
And Lucha?
Yes?
Can you do that Steve thing one time for us? Because I think you do it the best.
Steve.
Lucha.
Thank you very much, Lucha.
All right. Good night, y'all.
Okay, good night.
Okay.
Well,
yeah, Jimmy,
Stephen,
I just want to add something to Nani said there about how the Black Caucus doesn't say anything. I mean, once in the 90s when Samuel Cotton came back and after studying the slavery Black Africans in Mauritania, he presented his find. He wrote a book about it, too, by the way. It's quite a good book. And he presented his findings to a congressional committee, and there was a former African-American congressman who also testified who said that there was no slavery in Mauritania, even though he's black himself. And he's from California. His name, I think, was Mervyn DeMolly. And it turned out he did testify he was being paid $120,000 by the Mauritanian government. So I think this is one of the reasons we don't hear about it too often. I wouldn't be surprised if there's more payments going on behind the scene of key people, not to mention this or talk about this. It's amazing, like Samuel Cotton said, to hear this man whose ancestors were slaves stand up and defend a government that was enslaving blacks at that moment.
That's because they weren't white.
Well... You know, this was in before an American congressional committee. And yet he's presenting all this evidence and photos and everything else showing, yes, this is going on. So he was just, you know, he was a mercenary.
But I mean, if the enslavers had been white, then he would have been all over it. Right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah, sure, sure, sure. But then again, you never know. A person like, you know, people like this, you know, like they'll say anything or serve any master, you know, if the price is right.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, with the 6 or 7 minutes we have left, we see a lot of catastrophes now. We've got the Benghazi tragedy, Hillary's shameless testimony the other day. We've got these F-16s heading to Morsi, the Egyptian protesters in the street.
Well, that's upsetting, those F-16s.
And Obama not saying a thing. So go ahead, tell us. Tell us about the F-16s. Tell us about everything that's happening.
Well, I think the big story is going to be the implosion of Egypt. I said this on previous shows that, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood getting in power in Egypt didn't really disturb me that much because Egypt is a train wreck. And the people are hungry. Some people are surviving just one meal a day now. It just subsists on handouts from Turkey, Saudi Arabia, $1 billion here, $2 billion there. So what we're seeing there, I think the country is imploding. This is just the beginning. And you're going to see some very, very bad times ahead for Egypt. I think you're going to see chaos like you see in Syria. But that, of course, is going to be very bad for the whole region. And you're going to see a whole flood of refugees just get on boats, I think, and go across to Europe. Obama saying those F-16s is just obscenity. These people are hungry. He should have sent a ship full of wheat on every single bag. He should have had an American flag and said, from the American people to the people of Egypt. Then they know who's feeding them, who cares about them. Why is he sending F-16s to a country that can't even feed itself is beyond me. It just doesn't make any sense.
But why would an American administration be sending F-16s to the Muslim Brotherhood when it is the goal of the Muslim Brotherhood to destroy Western civilization in America?
Well, the only thing I can think of is that they're trying to keep people busy on the assembly lines, you know, in the arms industry. I just can't really think of any reason except that it's some type of a deal that we don't really know all the particulars about.
Well, I have an idea for you. Maybe the American president hates his own country and is siding with the enemies of the United States and wants to see the enemies of the United States prevail. We know the Islamists are going to attack Israel. He's arming Egypt, and we know that the war is coming against Israel, and he is arming the people that are going to attack Israel, and he's arming the people that are going to hurt American security interests, and that's what Obama wants.
The problem with that is the Muslim Brotherhood's strategy isn't to attack Israel for quite a while. It wants to build a strong Egypt. That's their strategy, and I don't understand why Obama isn't getting on the train with that strategy. They want to invest $15 billion in agriculture. It needs about $150 billion worth of investment in Egypt. Egypt knows it's no match for Israel at the moment. That's why it hasn't attacked Israel since 1973. Its army is not much good except for crowd control. So, like I said, I've read the Muslim Brotherhood strategy for eventually confronting Israel. That's quite a few years down the road. They want to build a strong Egypt first, and
Steve,
then
what's gonna be, Steve,
confront
what's
Israel.
Steve, what's going to be happening with the Christians in the Middle East?
Well, like I said, I think I said on your radio show before, we got to be ready to receive 5 to 8 million refugees from Egypt, Christians and moderate Muslims. They're going to be persecuted. I think this is the type of chaos that Al-Qaeda loves. If Egypt descends into chaos, like Somalia, like Syria, you can just expect to see fighter groups. Don't forget, the Salafists, who are ideologically related to Al-Qaeda, I think they got 25% of the seats in the Egyptian parliament. These people already have their armed groups, and I don't know why they're holding back in the demonstrations when they've seen the Office of the Muslim Brotherhood be burned and all this. I really don't know what's holding them back, but I don't think they'll allow any secular government to ever get into power in Egypt without a fight, some kind of civil war going on there.
Steve, what do you think about the report about the Iranian nuclear plant being blown up?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why Israel hasn't gone in after Iran.
Do you think it was Israel did the sabotage? Or?
I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised at all. They had that computer sabotage, the Stuxnet virus, that ruined a lot of the computers there. And that's one of the reasons I think Israel hasn't attacked Iran, is that its sabotage program is going so well, there might be no need for a formal attack.
That's a better way to go.
Why bother risking casualties and getting involved in a war and all this type of thing when a little sabotage can go along?
And no one knows exactly what happened.
There's always that element of deniability. Hey, we didn't do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Except they said it happened. And the IAEA, didn't they say it didn't happen?
Well, this is it. We're going to have to wait to see what happened here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can we get some kind of reliable confirmation of what happened there?
Reza Khalili, you know, he's worked for the CIA. He used to be in the Republican Guard.
Oh yeah, yeah. But
you know who he is?
See, I think they know the intelligence agencies what happened.
He's the one who reported on it.
The spy satellites have gone over there and photographed it, and they know by looking at the explosion what happened there.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, of course, you know, that's the unwashed. Unknowing people, they're not going to let us know for quite a while, if at all, you know. So we have to wait. I'm sure the intelligence agencies have already photographed the damages.
Like 200 people trapped underneath the thing or something.
Yeah.
And they're not making any effort to rescue them because they don't want the news to get a hold of it.
Like I said, I need something like that. I'd like to know get some confirmation or something about what's really going on there.
Well, this is from that Reza Khalili. You know, he has a blog or he posts online.
I'm not saying what he's saying is true. But, what I usually do is I wait till I read, get two or three other sources and confirmation. Because often the first reports often turn out to be wrong. So it's best just to wait to see. You know what I do? I just wait to see and what others have to say. The information trickles out. I'd love to see, of course, I'd love to interview the head of the CIA and see what he thinks. He knows what happened there, but of course he's not going to talk. And
we only have 1 minute left. Steve, before we go, we started with the Arab slave trade. Let's end with it. Let me ask you this. Where are the Muslim abolitionists?
There's never been a Muslim abolition movement, just very, very small. I told you about that Islamic theologian in Egypt. He had to leave the country when he said that having slaves, it's very, very difficult to get a Muslim abolition movement going. Same with the black African countries have said nothing because they're being paid by the Islamic countries not to say anything. So it's... they have the biggest stake, the black African countries.
Mm-hmm.
So abolition is going to be a very, very difficult thing, especially with Islamic fundamentalism and extremism growing in the Arab world that wants to rule by Sharia law.
Thank you, Steve. We are out
You're
of
welcome,
time.
You're welcome, Jamie.
Stephen Brown, thank you very much for joining the show and sharing your knowledge with us on the Arab slave trade. Diane Zinn, thank you very much for co-hosting the show tonight and for your expertise in the technical wizardry behind the scenes. And we will see you all next week.
It's good to...
Okay,
yes,
good night,
Diane.
Good night.
Bye.
Diane?
Yes.
You wanted to say something?
I was saying goodbye to Steve.
Oh, okay. And we'll talk to you all soon. Thank you for joining the Jamie Glassoff Show. Good night. Can you see? Bye.
proud.